Hello from Ellensburg, Washington, USA. This is the Nick Zentner Geology Podcast, episode 129, Alphabet Downtown. Thank you for listening. It's early March of 2025, dear listener, and hello. This is your old friend, Nick Zentner. It's been since January 1st since I've done one of these audio podcasts. And I have a reasonable excuse. If you're a regular listener to these episodes on the radio, in other words, audio podcasts in your phone, on your desktop, however you consume podcast content, it's been a while because I have been deeply into an alphabet, the Cascades A to Z live stream series. And I think today's episode is talking to people who consumed all 26 of those letters and were with us every step of the way. Now that's an average of 2 hours per letter per episode, and I think there's 26 letters in the alphabet, so that means we have more than 50 hours of Cascades content, quote unquote, that was delivered to the audience through YouTube. So I think if you did not participate, have no interest in hearing about the alphabet, things that we learned, and more specifically, me getting ready for 3 brand new lectures in a few weeks delivered in downtown Ellensburg. If this doesn't appeal to you, then I guess I'll see you the next time I do one of these, and hopefully I can get back to doing these things in a regular way. But that's the plan today. So to explain the title, I'd like to talk about the Cascades A to Z live stream series and talk about some things that just naturally bubble up into my mind as a recap of the alphabet, combined with asking for some specific help for those of you that did watch all those episodes, paid attention, possibly even took notes or whatever. I think I'm looking for an email from some of you, if you have the time and the interest and you feel like you want to help out a little bit. My email address is Nick, N-I-C-K, at geology.cwu.edu. You know, I teach geology at Central Washington University, cwu.edu. And if you do send me an email, please, in the subject line, can you put the word down, D-O-W-N. Abbreviation for downtown. So that's really the motivation. I have started after taking kind of a week off. I finished the alphabet a week and a half ago, I guess. And I've just been totally unplugged. I've been doing some other things related to geology, but nothing to do with this alphabet, nothing to do with the Cascades. So I've had my mind turned off for, let's say, 10 days. And now here I am on March 8th. Realizing that less than a month from now, I need to have 3 downtown lectures that are fast-paced, that are half an hour of chalkboard, half an hour of slides. The slides are no problem. I have all the slides from all those Cascades A to Z live stream sessions. Those slides are there. Lots of graphics, lots of beautiful photos, animation, number of things that came specifically from our sessions, our brainstorming sessions, our learning sessions, and I was learning right along with everybody else. But what I'm really drilling down to right now is, what am I going to do for 3 lectures back to back, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night in downtown Ellensburg? If you're interested in coming, you're certainly welcome to April 3rd, 4th, and 5th, the first weekend in April of 2025, Morgan Middle School on First Avenue in Ellensburg. There's an auditorium. There's more than 700 seats. It's free and open to the public. Anybody who wants to just waltz in there is totally fine. You can come to one night. You can come to all 3 if you want. Many people are coming in from a long way away, and they're going to make it an experience and attend all 3 of the lectures. 7 p.m., Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Okay, so that's the context for this, and I'm looking for some help trying to take all this material from the Cascades series and trying to get it into 3 lectures. Here's what I think I have so far, but I'm interested in hearing from you if you feel like I'm missing the mark. Thursday night, I think I want to talk about plate tectonics and asking why did the Cascade Mountain Range begin? How did it form? How long have we had these beautiful stratovolcanoes in the Pacific Northwest? Washington, Oregon, Northern California, a little bit up in British Columbia. And I think I start with a simple sketch of a convergent oceanic versus continental plate boundary, and I say I've been doing this sketch forever, but when did that start? When did we start subducting an ocean plate in the Pacific Northwest to make the volcanoes? Is it related to Pangaea? Is it related to something else? Have we had the same ocean plate diving beneath Washington and Oregon for 200 million years or 100 million years or 50 million years? What's the answer? And specifically from the alphabet, everyone that I talked to, whether it was by recorded Zoom interview or whether it was featuring papers and everything, everybody agrees that 46 is the number now. 46 million years ago was the beginning of the Cascade Volcanic Arc, was the beginning of a subducting ocean plate underneath the Pacific Northwest. Well, why 46? What's special about that number? And more specifically than that, why are we beginning an ocean plate subduction story precisely at 46? And not 40, and not 200, and not 120, you know, okay. And which plate was it? So suddenly that means we need to get into what does the Pacific Ocean Basin look like through time? Which tectonic plates are where, and what directions are those plates going? And more to the point, are there spreading ridges out in that water? In other words, the Pacific Basin, okay, new thought right now. As I'm imagining drawing, I'm using chalkboards now. So I need to have a fast-paced thing where I'm not just standing there talking. I've looked at a few downtown lectures I've done the last couple of years, and I think a mistake that I made was the first 10 minutes of one of those lectures, I was just standing there talking. I wasn't even using the boards until like literally the 10 minutes into the frickin' thing. As soon as I start these lectures in early April, I want to get to the chalk right away. I love the chalkboards. It's a comfort item for me. I started teaching geology in the late 1980s. So this relationship with chalkboards and pieces of chalk is just, that's not going away. And, okay, I'm pausing because, yeah, okay, right. So I want to get to drawing right away. And I think the idea is I want to draw some maps of these ocean plates and where these spreading ridges are. But I'm getting hung up because nobody really knows for sure which plate it was. Nobody knows for sure what the ocean spreading ridges looked like at certain points in time. There's a million different maps. They're all ideas. They're all tectonic models to explain their data. But I think the main point of this first lecture, this Thursday night lecture, is that we have some knowns. We know what a volcanic arc magma looks like versus magmas that are older than 46 million years old that have the wrong geochemistry to say this. You know, that we're making these magmas earlier than 46 million years ago. Okay, that's another thought. Maybe I don't need emails from you. Maybe I just talk to myself as I stared against a wall in a dimly lit room in the basement. Bijou's taking a nap. Okay, so maybe this is okay, we've got a bunch of magmas in Washington that are in the Cascades, but they're older than 46 million years old, and their geochemistry says they have nothing to do with the subducting ocean plate. Good God, am I really going to get into geochemistry with a chalkboard? I doubt it, but you can kind of see where I am. I'm grappling with the green M&M. Again, I'm talking to you if you've watched the series. So the green M&M lectures, The green M&M was a trick that I was using this past series to say every time that we have a spreading ridge that is disappearing underneath North America, we're literally subducting a spreading ridge. We're subducting a plate boundary. I would put a green dot at the coast of Washington at a time and a place where we knew that that spreading ridge was subducting. And how did we know that green M&M was planted there? Well, we have evidence that there's arc magmas to the north and to the south, but not right at the green M&M because we're subducting a ridge. We're not subducting a plate. And there's tomography or geophysical data that tells us that there was a slab window or some sort of place where we were subducting a window, as a subducting a gap. All these phrases are coming back to me right now. I'm realizing there's a lot there. How am I going to do this? Okay, let me finish my train of thought, and then we can dig a little deeper into a couple of these specific topics, if you like. Okay, so that's Thursday night. Something tied to that. The title will probably be, How Did the Cascade Range Form? Something like that. And then Friday night, I'm not sure, but I think I might want to do something with calderas. It felt like the caldera stuff late in the alphabet was exciting. I think a lot of the excitement of the calderas in the Cascades was in response to some of the viewers going way beyond the normal participation. There were a few viewers that I nicknamed Team Caldera, and that was Glenn from Spokane and Lindsay from Seattle and Tom from Maple Valley and a few others that don't come to mind at the moment, but they were Gary Paul from Darrington. They were all collaborating on going through the research, using some posters by Dave Tucker up at Bellingham, Washington, and making a spreadsheet of all the known mapped calderas in the Pacific North. All of the known or inferred or suspected calderas in the Cascades. And calderas are larger than craters. Like if you go to Mount St. Helens, that's not a caldera. That's a crater that formed in 1980. The scale that we're talking about is Crater Lake in southern Oregon. That's a classic caldera that's in the Cascades, which until a few years ago is the only caldera that I knew of in the Cascades. And then I started hearing about calderas being discovered up by Mount Baker, the Hannigan caldera, roughly 3 million years old. And then more recently, the Culshan caldera, which is right at Mount Baker. So Mount Baker, the cone of Mount Baker, has grown on top of or within this larger 1 million year old Culshan caldera. So up until this winter, I knew of three calderas. Well, now we're up to more than two dozen, I guess, based on Team Caldera and their inventory work, taking their cues from Paul Hammond and Dave Tucker. And this idea that all of these calderas in the Cascades have been just hiding in plain sight. We've got people inferring calderas from 30 million years ago, 20 million years ago, 10 million years ago, in places that are very well known. Snoqualmie Pass area, Chinook Pass area, places that don't have cones today. But the idea is that these field mappers of generations past would make maps and say, we got a lot of pyroclastic flows. We have a lot, we have a thick pile of ashy material, of pyroclastic flows. We have a sharp boundary around this package of very thick material. And on maps, oftentimes, the distribution of those thick piles of, let's just say, ashy explosive deposits are roughly circular. Like you have your little pencil on your field map, and you're like, well, this package of what ends up being called caldera fill is 30 miles across, 50 miles across, whatever the dimension is. And so the volcanic breccias, other kinds of smaller scale type features, ring dikes, no, that's not it. But the idea is that with imagination, you can infer some of these explosive volcanic events in the Cascades. So maybe that Friday night is the caldera lecture, and I start with, I think I'm most comfortable starting with 101 type content, saying, here's what I've taught forever and ever, that the Cascades mostly just have intermediate magmas, have andesites, have stratovolcanoes. That's the geology 101 stuff that my students have written into their little notebooks for years and years and years. I mean, I'm teaching kids now of students that I had 30 years ago, 25 years ago. It's like, hey, thanks for taking 101. Yeah, my mom took your class. It's like, oh, God. Yeah. So we start with that, and then we go, well, no, I've learned recently that all silica contents are not only possible, but they are common in a volcanic arc like the Cascades. In other words, you can get basalts, andesites, dacites, and rhyolites. Now, why are we getting rhyolites? And what should we visualize? Are we really talking about super volcano-type explosions, super eruptions, a la Yellowstone? I don't think anybody's talking about hotspots intersecting the trend of the Cascades. But the fact that we're just finding these, let's say, 20 additional Cascades that we didn't really have on anybody's maps or in any published reports until like the last 10 years, I think that's new and exciting. But some of the most obvious questions remain problematic. So I think before I get to Saturday night, that's my general quandary, is that if I lay out this stuff and like, this is what I used to think 30 years ago, and now I've been keeping up with some new papers and some new conversations with geologists, and it seems like the old stuff is not accurate anymore. And here are some new options related to the old statements and how wrong it was. I don't know how to finish a lecture if it's just open-ended. Is that satisfying enough to say the old story is wrong and here are three options that are possible? And thanks for coming, everybody. I guess that's what I do. But I was just talking to Jordan Carey about this on a long car ride yesterday. And I'm like, do I need some resolution or some, you know, you start with an old idea, then you explore three new ideas, and then you say, and here's the data that says that this one of the three new ideas is the right one. Rarely do we get that, especially if there's a reexamination of old ideas. Okay, I'm realizing right now, like, that's what I have done. Rocky Mountain Lectures, some other things. I just talk about how the old stuff is not aging well. The old ideas, the old papers, the old diagrams. I can just use a diagram. Here's a diagram on a chalkboard that I've done for 25 years, and I'm not going to be stubborn and just keep drawing it because I know that there's new data to say that old diagram is wrong. Okay. You're like, I'm listening to this. I haven't clicked it off yet, but like, what am I supposed to do here? I'm supposed to send you an email? Yeah, let me share Saturday night, my tentative plan here, 3 weeks before the thing happens. And if you don't like my three ideas, if you feel like there is a major lecture with a title even that you have in mind that I'm just forgetting about, like you're like, holy cow, what about F through J? Did you forget about how cool that stuff was? To me, that's way more interesting than the caldera thing. That's what I'm interested in. Maybe if you email me and take the time to email me, subject line down, maybe you give me your three talk titles if you were doing it. And maybe two of them are in line with what I'm sharing right now, but maybe your third one is totally different. Okay, so what's my Saturday night? What's the thrilling conclusion? if you view these, I mean, that's ambitious, but I think possibly the three nights build on each other. and that they're viewed as a set. I'm not sure that's necessary, because most of the time people find, they'll be filmed, they'll be put on YouTube, and there's wild differences in popularity. That's not my goal, but, the Rocky Mountain lectures, crazy high numbers of views. Other lectures that I think are just as good, maybe even better. Excuse me. I apologize. Some of the Ice Age lectures last year, I thought were particularly good, and they've the view numbers are way less. So you never know what's going to take hold and be shared by people. But again, I've commented for many years, that's never in my calculations. I'm not trying to find something to make a bunch of money, because if I can find just the right clickbaity thing, everybody will view it and I'll cash in. No money involved. Okay. So it's just pure satisfaction. And it's trying to find the three themes from this past winter's alphabet that are the obvious three topics that should be covered. If you've seen the whole alphabet, the three most natural, obvious, exciting topics that best summarize and best capture the discovery that we had together as a community. All right, what's Saturday night? Saturday night has to be, I think, the uplift of the Cascades. I don't know what the title is. It could be, did the flood basalts of Eastern Washington cross the Cascades? That's maybe the leader in the clubhouse for the title. And to be totally honest, I was really excited about the topic as we were doing it. I thought maybe I'd just find the right interview or the right map or the right something to find some Columbia River basalt lavas in Western Washington that nobody really paid any attention to, and that would truly be a super intoxicating moment where we can get this idea that these flood basalts really did cross the Cascades when the Cascades were low, and most of the flood basalts have been eroded. Almost all of the flood basalts have eroded, but there was a time when those great lava sheets were continuous from Eastern Washington to Western Washington. And then there's been so much rapid uplift of the Cascades recently to erode almost all those thick German chocolate cake layers, except for a few scraps here and there. But the smoking gun would be some Columbia River basalts in Western Washington. And then you go, well, wait a minute, aren't there? I thought there were some Columbia River basalt lavas around Centralia and Chehalis and over by Gray's Harbor. And there are. And maybe that's what I lean into. You find 16-million-year-old Grand Ronde lava flows that erupted out of fissures by damn near Idaho. And here are some of those impressive lava flows at Gray's Harbor. That's a fact. But the story is, you get those thick basaltic lava flows to Gray's Harbor by having those lava flows funnel through the Columbia River Gorge. And by the time you get those Grand Ronde lavas into Western Washington, some of those Grand Ronde lavas are going to flow and surge their way and march their way north. North from Portland to Gray's Harbor. But when you look at a map, those same Grand Ronde lavas are at Chelan in Eastern Washington, Wenatchee in Eastern Washington. And as the crow flies, it's a much more direct shot to have those thick Grand Ronde lavas, which suddenly stop, by the way, at Wenatchee. They suddenly stop at Chelan. They're thick at Chelan and Wenatchee. And that's the main argument for those thick Grand Ronde lava flows 16 million years ago to cross the low Cascades. Because why are they so thick? They don't pinch out as they approach the Cascades. They just suddenly stop. And everyone in geology agrees that those thick lavas used to extend further west, but the conventional thought is that they extended another 5 or 10 miles up into the Cascades before they they pinched out and stopped. Well, why couldn't you take some thick Grand Ronde lavas at Yakima and have them cross the Cascades and go straight to Chehalis? Why couldn't you just follow US 12 when the White Pass area was extremely low in elevation? Sorry about the throat here. It's early morning. So that gets us into, when did the Cascades go from low elevation to high elevation, which gets us to why do this rain shadow effect that we have today, which is extremely wet western Washington and extremely dry eastern Washington, when did that get set up? That was late in the alphabet, and it realized that we've got the rain shadow forming and becoming established less than 10 million years ago. Pretty much everybody says that. And a few say that it's not until 3 million years ago that you do dramatic uplift during the Ice Age time to create the high Cascades, to create the rain shadow. Middle of the road is something like 7 million years ago. So to me, that one seems to have a lot of muscle on the bone and can go many different directions. And maybe that's Saturday night. So my thought currently here is tectonics, green M&M on Thursday night, calderas, and do something with the calderas, which right now that's the weakest of the three lectures in my mind. And then the uplift on Saturday night. You're still with me 26 minutes into the episode, which means that you must have watched the live stream series and are invested in this and are now actively thinking about other aspects of what we did together, you know, all through the roaring 20s with Paul Hammond, or the 30s with the Ohana Pakosh and all the green stuff, and that was low Cascades. We did so much early in the alphabet with the blue time, the 40s, and there was the rollback and the breakoff belt magmas and all these pre-Cascade volcanic arc units that we now have in the Cascades, which are not a volcanic arc story. Maybe there's so much there. Maybe there's so much in blue time that could be two nights, and not instead of just cramming it all into the first night, Thursday night. And then I did enjoy all that basement stuff with the Arcosic melange. We spent quite a few letters talking about the Russell Ranch formation within the Rimrock Lake Inlier. A look at the basement surrounding by younger volcanics in the South Cascades, and then tried to make some connections with what we know north of I-90 in the North Cascades. Tried to project, in other words, the basement units that we have in the North Cascades and tried to project them to the South Cascades, even though they're mostly invisible or not available to us. They're buried, in other words. But the concept that you can take some of this Arcosic melange, which you can see up by Granite Falls, up by Everett, Washington, you can project some of that same basement stuff. Using geophysics, you can project it all the way down to beneath the Columbia River Gorge and into Oregon. That was fun because nobody's really been saying much about that, but I think we cobbled together a story there. I don't know if that's a chalkboard lecture necessarily. So I think you maybe have a feel for where I am, and I'll just wrap this one up, dear listener, by saying that I have hit a wall. That was a lot of energy, a lot of time devoted to each of those letters. And I love routine, and I love feeling productive, but there's a cumulative effect there. So Liz said, well, you're going to fall apart? Because that's normally the pattern. After an intense quarter of teaching or an intense something else where it's a sustained effort for a long time, just that change in the routine, I just kind of hit a wall and I just start staring at walls and drinking hot water, sitting in the sun and doing nothing, and having a hard time finding motivation to do anything. I'm flirting with that feeling right now. But I do enjoy sitting down, especially early in the morning, doing something like this, just trying to be creative and try to just chip away at a project. And right now, that project is every day just trying to add a few new things to these downtown lectures in early April. And then beyond that, I think I'll be teaching Geology 351, and that's probably going to be it. I think I'm just going to do two live streams a week. And at least the way I'm feeling right now, I don't have any motivation to make a bunch of field videos or go out and explore anything. It's maybe you can relate, but if you give it your all to a particular topic, it feels great when you're doing it, but when you're finally done, there's a nice feeling of satisfaction. And I've heard from many people that out of all the alphabets that I've done the last 5 years, the Cascades one was their favorite. And it's especially interesting from people who are saying, I thought for sure the Cascade alphabet was going to suck compared to the, you know, the Brett stuff we did last year or the Baja BC. So there were, I guess, low expectations from some. Like, I don't know what you were going to find in the Cascades. It's just a bunch of cones, bunch of, you know, stratovolcanoes. What are you going to really have 26 letters on the Cascades? And we did it, and many people really enjoyed letter after letter exploring these narratives that were buried in the foothills of the Cascades, which are often overlooked by everyone. So just on a personal note, I'm just kind of chipping away. I think when I do deliver these downtown lectures, that will be a nice feeling of satisfaction as well. And then, I don't know, I might be recharged by that point, or spring might be a pretty quiet time on the YouTube channel. That's the beauty of not doing all the money stuff and the subscribers and Patreon and everything else. I do not feel an obligation. And I still like that model, that if I'm out, I'm out. And I don't have to produce X number of programs to satisfy the people who are writing checks. I like that freedom. I hope you enjoy your freedom. And I hope that you enjoy springtime here in North America and around the world in the Northern Hemisphere. It's a great time of year. As I get older, springtime becomes more and more satisfying and palpable to me. Life showing up again. I hope things are going well with you. Thank you for listening to this episode entitled Alphabet Downtown. Thank you, I love you, and goodbye from Ellensburg, Washington, USA.